So, Senator Sanders, you're going to run for president.
I am going to run for president. That's correct.
What's going to be different this time?
We're going to win. We are going to also launch what I think is unprecedented in modern American history, and that is a grassroots movement, John, to lay the groundwork for transforming the economic and political life of this country. That's what's different.
Welcome to The Reason Podcast. I'm your new host. I've staged a revolution against the oligarchs.
That was good, wasn't it? No?
I'm sorry, were you doing
Matt,
something, Matt?
Matt, it's too early for
Hi,
that.
Everyone. Welcome to the Reason Podcast Editor's Roundtable edition. I'm Matt Welch. This is a special Tuesday drop following the Washington Lincoln Day yesterday. And we're feeling the burn from the drop. With me are our regulars, Peter Suderman and Nick Gillespie, and our irregular managing editor, Stephanie Slade from Reason. A round of applause out there in listener
Irregular, huh?
Hey,
that's
Matt.
We're libertarians, so like irregulars are the best. So this morning, boom, Bernie announced there.
Happy Tuesday,
yeah,
right?
I mean, super
Shrove
happy,
Tuesday.
Tuesday. I want to start with by let's doff our hats to how Bernie Sanders has changed the national conversation, arguably for the worse, but he's certainly changed it a whole lot. Peter, I want to start with you because you're a policy person there in DC. How has Bernie Sanders changed the Democratic Party as an independent, changed the Democratic Party's policy agenda over the last 4 years, in your estimation?
Yeah, let's talk about the independent part a little bit later. But I think it's really worth just dwelling on how different the Democratic Party's national policy agenda was even 2 years ago. In 2 or 3 years ago in the 2016 presidential race, where Hillary Clinton was not running on single payer, was not running on really on these sort of the grand climate vision that is included in the Green New Deal, was where a few years before that, President Obama really shied away from the $15 minimum wage. He had advisors, economic advisors, to him, saying things like, "Well, the $12 minimum wage is at the sort of the far end of what we could possibly justify." And you just did not see that sort of policy ambition, the scale of government intervention that that you now see as the norm in the Democratic Party, where you see if there is a front runner right now, it's Kamala Harris, and she has endorsed the Green New Deal, which has basically the entire progressive policy agenda it contained within it, as well as Medicare for All, even going so far as to say, sure, we should eliminate private health insurance, a statement that she didn't exactly walk back, but kind of expanded upon by saying, well, maybe we could do something else instead on the way to eliminating private health insurance. And so in just the space of a couple of years, the Democratic Party has really moved to the left when it comes to economic policy. And Bernie Sanders is a big part of the reason for that, because when he got into the race against Hillary Clinton, the last Democratic primary, it was assumed that he was a fringe weirdo nobody who had no chance. He was running something like 40 or 50 points behind. And he said, nope, I'm here to win. I'm going to play this game to win. And he put up a tough fight, drew huge crowds to his rallies, and really, really, really shaped the Democratic Party in doing so. And I mean, obviously, part of that is the reaction to Trump and the Trump era. But Bernie Sanders showed that there was a real demand for a bold, big, huge scale, ambitious economic policy agenda on the left. And it's kind of fascinating that he did this coming from a position as an independent, as a city mayor to begin with. And that he has pulled the Democratic Party, yes, by working within it through his presidential campaign, but also by being an independent and by sort of refusing to toe the Democratic Party line. There was a Washington Post reporter tweeted out Sanders' 2020 agenda, according to his aides. And so I just want to go through it real quick before I end here. It's Medicare for all, Green New Deal or climate change, $15 minimum wage, criminal justice reform, free college, break up the biggest banks, gender pay equity, paid leave, reducing drug prices, expanding Social Security, saving unions, the DREAM Act, as well as background checks and an assault weapons ban, which is a little bit interesting, given that Bernie Sanders has been not exactly the most gun controlling of the Democratic candidates. Also, legalizing pot, abolish private prisons, end cash bail, major police department reform, and opposing the military-industrial complex. That's Bernie Sanders' agenda. But what's interesting is, in a lot of ways, that's the Democratic Party's agenda right now. And that wasn't true even for
Nick. I want you to get your speculating hat on here a little bit. In
I just put on my Hogwarts sorting hat. So it's going to take a while.
I mean, that's just assumed. You can it has a mind of its own.
I think Bernie is Hufflepuff all the way.
How much do you think the Bernie phenomenon is and was a product of the uniquely anti-competitive nature of the 2016 election itself, which is to say Hillary Clinton wiped out the field. She kneecapped everyone. She got that guy from Karate Kid to sweep the leg of the field to begin with. And so only like a barky socialist and like Jim Webb shouting at clouds and some rando from Baltimore would even think about running. And so there was this pent up energy against, rightly so, against sort of a preordained I deserve this kind of candidate. And it happened to go to the barky socialist. But if it was anybody else with a pulse, maybe it would have gone there and maybe it wouldn't have been the same basket of policy ideas. And I'm even adding more to this, part of the 2010 or 2018 midterm wave for Democrats, the people who won with a couple of loud exceptions like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, were not Bernie Sanders types. Yeah. So is it possible that Democrats and people in the media, and I might be repeating myself, are overestimating the amount of super revolutionary leftism that's out there in the world?
Wow. I don't know where to begin. Yeah. Are you done or are you just taking a breath?
That was a pretty good speech.
Yeah. Let me say, I think that you're broadly correct and that it's, you know, that Hillary was both the consensus candidate among Democrats and among the political establishment, both among Democrats and Republicans. She was going to be the candidate. And that creates a lot of space for somebody to really kind of be the counterweight. And Bernie emerged from that partly because he didn't give a shit, partly because he was appealing to people in an interesting way, which I think is also true of Donald Trump, where there was a consensus or an establishment candidate who was Jeb Bush, who just never really performed at the level he needed to. And then there were, you know, more than a dozen other people floating around. But I think what's important is that Sanders, unlike, say, Martin O'Malley, you know, rest in peace, was a populist. And we are in a populist moment. And by that, I mean the push is to topple over the existing order. You know, I've said this in various ways, none of which are particularly articulate, but, you know, the long 20th century is over, but we're still living in it and under its policies and things like that. So that, you know, Medicare doesn't cut it anymore. We need either to get rid of Medicare or we need to bring Medicare for all. American interventionism doesn't cut it anymore. We either need to be super hawks or we need to be much less interventionist. And you can see Trump and Sanders, you know, there were a lot of similarities. They ran against the status quo. They ran on anger and frustration and a feeling of not being represented. So I think you're right. And that it also, we need to encompass that into Trump. What's interesting is, I don't think, you know, to go to your larger point, I think people want something different. I actually don't think that they want what Sanders is selling them, because the minute you go beyond, you know, below the headline of Medicare for all, free college for all, you know, everything for, you know, for all, people start to back away from it because they understand that this is impractical. And actually, rather than being a break with the past, it is merely the logical extension of policies that are already killing us with debt and lower than average economic growth, et cetera.
Slade, I like to typecast you as a polling person since you have some expertise in that field. And it comes up in all of this. In most of the polls that I've glanced at to date in the Democratic field, you always see near the top Biden kind of clearing away. And then Bernie Sanders is usually around second in the kind of imagined field. And now I guess he's in it. Do we take those things seriously? Is this just name recognition of old people? What at this point can we glean from, or how can we read polls at this stage in a presidential election?
Matt, I sometimes think that the entire reason I come on this podcast is just to like deflate your bubble every time. No, we can't take anything away from these polls. They don't mean anything. It's so incredibly too early to be drawing any conclusions whatsoever from them. I mean, studies have shown in the past that the polls only begin to start to maybe be predictive in December of this year, the 1 year out. There's nothing predictive about the polls right now. I was looking.
What about maybe not about the polls, Slate, but what about Sanders' finish last time or Biden's office holding record?
I mean, sure, the record matters, and we can talk about those things. But if we're trying to draw conclusions from how people are polling from what the sort of favorability numbers are or support numbers are, they don't tell us anything at this point. I mean, actually, I was looking at 4 years ago and 8 years ago, and you can't even look at this point 4 years ago and 8 years ago because like the Real Clear Politics polling average begins in May. So we're still like two, three months out from the point when the earliest polls were taken and aggregated last time around. And at that point, you know, on the Republican side, you had Bush in the lead, then Rubio, then Walker, then Paul, then Cruz, then Huckabee. Okay.
Yeah. Rand Paul, I think, spent nearly a year pretty close to the top of the field in 2015 or 2014. Back then, which obviously amounted to a hill of beans.
Right.
So the polls will be meaningful, though, starting in June when the debates start. We have a two-night extravaganza coming in June in which candidates can qualify by getting 1% support in three qualifying polls. You can also qualify by getting $65,000 worth of individual donations from 200 donors. But the polls become important in that they say who can get on that stage, which
sure.
is going to, or the multiple stages, I guess, over a couple of nights, which is going to be quite
is
crowded
it gonna be,
this time around.
Sure. So
is it
going to
be a sleepover and like pillow fights and stuff?
Mm. It's like a Big Brother.
Maybe at your house, Matt.
It should be a reality TV show, all the candidates in one mansion.
To go to your point, though, Sanders, and, Peter elaborated on this, Sanders has changed the standard kind of platform of a Democratic candidate now. And there's no question that even somebody like Amy Klobuchar, who is running as a centrist, is actually, in favor of a lot of big government stuff. And she's not, she's not a breakout candidate. And then when you look at people like Kamala Harris and whatnot, who's talking about abolishing private insurance, walking it back to be sure. But, Sanders has already had a major influence on things, unless... and even if somebody like Biden comes in, he's going to be running far, more to the left of what he was in 2012 or as a vice president.
Slade, I shot you a poll or at least a link to an article that was based on some polling from Harry Enten over at CNN. And he's making the argument right now that compared to other times in recent history, Democrats are elevating electability as a stronger value than before. Is that another poll that we should just put away and wait for a year from now? Or is that does that tell us something interesting about what this competition is going to look like?
I don't have as strong of an answer on this, but I'm also a little skeptical of that finding. It's because this is the kind of polling question that I would sort of describe as like a meta question. They don't say, who are you planning on voting for and then why? What was the number one factor that determined your choice for, Harris over Biden or whatever? Instead, they just say, hypothetically speaking, which of the following generic characteristics is more important to you, policy or electability. And in that case, I mean, you're just asking people to like do a lot of mental gymnastics to guess at what they're actually going to be motivated by when the time comes. And without any names attached to the question, I don't think it tells us as much as we might like about how people will actually act. Because oftentimes people say things like, oh, I'm all about the policy, or, you know, I'm all about the electability because I'm a realist and we just need to beat Donald Trump. When the time comes, if somebody is really exciting, is on the ballot, and they get really excited by that person's policy ideas, that could easily swamp what they said 6 months out, 8 months out, a year out, about what was going to be their top motivation.
I think the other thing that's worth noting about Sanders is that unlike a bunch of the other 2020 Democratic primary candidates, he is, at least as of today, talking very directly about President Trump. And the quote that Sanders gave this morning is, "We are running against a president who is a pathological liar, a fraud, a racist, a sexist, a xenophobe, and someone who is undermining American democracy as he leads us in an authoritarian direction." That's kind of all.
Kind of sounds like Bill Weld there.
Even someone like Kamala Harris, who is obviously, you know, sort of very anti-Trump in a lot of ways, tends to avoid naming President Trump when she's been out campaigning so far, has not focused on him directly. And it's additionally, I think, a marked contrast from what we saw in the midterm election, where Democrats won in large part by avoiding direct talk of Trump, or avoiding too much of it, and also avoiding talk of impeachment, and instead focusing on kind of basic kitchen table economics issues, in particular the pre-existing conditions rules in Obamacare, which Nancy Pelosi has basically said that's what won it for us. And in addition, you've actually seen some Republicans in leadership. There's a report that Kevin McCarthy basically said in a closed-door meeting, well, they beat us because we didn't have a response on pre-existing conditions. And so there's been a big shift in the space of just a couple of months in terms of how Democrats are running. And I think Sanders is both has both drawn the field in that direction with his 2016 campaign and kind of with his politics up until then, and is also leading that in a lot of ways with his agenda.
If I can jump in here for a second, though, an essential backdrop of this, I think, is the absolute lack of party affiliation that Americans increasingly show. And that, you know, one of the reasons why Trump was able to win, I think, is that there were fewer Republicans than there used to be. And, you know, and similarly, weird things can happen. The Democrats are, you know, around 34-35% of identification, of self-identification among voters. This is historically weak. And, you know, this from a libertarian point of view, I think what's interesting is that you have, on the one hand, you have Trump and his vision of nationalism and populism. And then on the other side, you have a kind of redistributionist socialism among the Democrats. That's kind of defining them, but is also mostly populist in its most potent forms. People like Elizabeth Warren, people like Bernie Sanders, and libertarians. What we need to do is to figure out how do we answer these questions, because we have, you know, clearly the economic arguments about the way that government spending chokes things off. It screws up a lot of stuff. And also, things like free trade and more open immigration. I think these are defensible policies, but we need to come up with a rhetoric that's going to cut against both, I think, a kind of right wing and a left wing populism that is not simply kind of holding our nose and saying we're smarter than other people. Like, we need to figure out what do we do to get the blood pumping in a libertarian message over the next few years, not because we're going to have a libertarian president, but we desperately need to get these ideas into play among a large number of disaffected people, not just independents, but people who are not ideologically right wing or left wing, but rather are, you know, and this gets, you know, pissed on all the time, but it is true, people who believe in capitalism and free markets and limited government. That is where, you know, the American center is. It doesn't mean they're moderate, but they are essentially libertarian, and we need to reach those people.
It was interesting to watch Bill Weld, who announced that he's forming an exploratory committee on Friday in New Hampshire to run against Donald Trump in the Republican primary there. It was interesting to watch how he kind of treated that particular issue, Nick, which is the kind of policy main thrust of his speech was aimed at the kind of Selena Zito, if I'm mispronouncing her name correctly, voter, like people who are going to be left behind because we're all becoming robots. And so extended paragraph after paragraph about like job retraining and this kind of stuff transforming the educational system, many of it in ways that are friendly to libertarian ears, sort of more choice, more vocational this, more that, community college emphasis, allowing people to focus on different types of skills. But that was his kind of approach towards the sense of kind of a disaffected, people who are feel like they're being left behind as society transforms. I don't have any predictions on how that will land, but that was his sense of responding to that particular thing. Peter, you live in Washington, D.C. Do you hear earfuls of trepidation that the Sanders Warren whoever the hell kind of a wing of the Democratic Party are just going to create a wide open lane for Howard Schultz, who, because polls are very important, has some of the largest negatives around just because Democrats hate his freaking guts right now. And in large part because he said, as he told The Washington Post, I think a couple of days ago, like, I'll step out as long as you guys don't nominate a Bernie Sanders. If you get me a centrist and I'm out of here. So a lot of people are thinking that he's taking them hostage. What do you hear there on the ground, Peter?
I just I hear no one thinking that Howard Schultz has a chance.
Sure, but that's not the question.
Even people who think that he has something, a few worthwhile things to say, don't think he has a chance at all. So here's how I would describe the race. Typically, when you see these big primary fields, you see a lot of candidates trying to jam the moderate sort of crossover centrist lane. And lanes are, of course, a sort of not super useful way of thinking about these things. But there's some validity to this, right? There's sort of groups or types of candidates that you can sort of reasonably lump together. And here in the Democratic primary race, at least so far, and again, it's quite early, but at least so far, what you're seeing is an awful lot of folks who are trying to jam the progressive wing, and the sense that that is where the base is at least the folks who are going to be voting in the primaries. And so what I would say is, that is a sort of unusual and interesting dynamic that does create an opening for a candidate who is perhaps a little more moderate, a little less sort of obviously sort of playing to the far left, to the sort of most vocal progressive activists. But probably given the actual shape of the Democratic base, it's not going to sort of make room for somebody who's just a sort of very conventional Joe Biden type, someone like that. So what I would say is, if I had to bet right now, and it's obviously very early and I am not betting, but if I had to bet right now, I would bet that the candidate who comes out of this is the most moderate candidate who is still acceptable to progressive voters.
So who is that?
Activists.
So you think
and
it's
so
Kamala
that,
Harris?
To me sounds like maybe Kamala Harris, but actually also sounds a lot like Amy Klobuchar, who is
I've got my salary
is,
riding on
someone
that.
Who is running on who had an interview with on MSNBC where Rachel Maddow was like, "Well, you're a moderate," and she was like, "No, I think the right way to think about me is more as a progressive." And then she's also saying, "Well, of course I support Medicare for all, but that's a longer term goal." She's trying to sort of split the difference here in ways that are somewhat interesting, but also in ways that I think won't ultimately really turn off the lefty activists who want sort of a bigger sort of more kind of blue sky policy vision, and so I think that she has a real chance if she can find a chief of staff and not avoid throwing office supply equipment at her.
During the Republican primaries last time around, I, to the shock of perhaps not Catherine Mangu Ward, had fun sorting people into different camps. And one of them was sort of the establishment friendly wing, the kind of Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, I kind of forget even who qualified for that. But at any given time, that group of people never, ever, if you added up all their percentages, including, you know, in the silly season of polling, was never more than 30% of the vote. Like, just like the adults in the room vote was never there. And the total rando outsider, like, I am so crazy, I'm going to make you think you're going crazy, vote, you know, Donald Trump, Ben Carson, et cetera, was always just super dominant, which makes me wonder, like, where is the rando total outsider here? Where is the John McAfee of the Democratic Party? I mean, maybe the Bernie Sanders is it now. I mean, I wonder if there is an appetite for even more kind of bottle throwing through the window with all of this. Slade, are we?
Well, there are some weirdo candidates running. I mean, in particular, I would note Marianne Williamson,
that's true.
Yeah, but
who nobody has heard of, but is like a spiritual guru who has decided that she's going to run. It's the kind of Republican model of a book tour presidential campaign, I assume, here.
Sanders is pretty out there, moving. I don't know how you get on the left of Sanders in American political history.
He's also pitching himself as a not quite a fringe candidate, but someone who is not attached to the establishment at all, even though, of course, he's a senator. But he's not. I mean, Kamala Harris is kind of pitching herself as the party juggernaut candidate. And even though she is she's running a campaign that is quite to the left of the big party juggernaut campaigns of past years, she is kind of aiming to take that spot of here is who the party will rally around. She's already sort of announcing endorsements.
The other thing I would add, though, is that not only is it too early to be putting a lot of stock in the polling numbers, or really any stock in the polling numbers, let me just repeat that, there's a lot of candidates or potential candidates that we're not even mentioning, and that nobody out in the real world, in real America, who's living lives that don't just revolve 100% of the time around electoral politics, have heard of. I mean,
wait,
nobody
people have lives like that now still.
I'm thinking of the Castro brothers, right? I'm thinking of Tulsi Gabbard probably has very low name recognition right now. There's a lot of people that are going to be a part of this conversation that we are not even thinking about because they haven't really broken through even at our level in many cases. And so I would just say, like, you know, Obama was not considered to be a serious person at this point, you know, whatever, 12
years
ago. And
Bernie Sanders wasn't 4 years ago.
Right. I mean, we could argue whether he is or not actually a serious person. But, you know, there's a lot of
people. He became a serious electoral force, though, in a way that people did not think would happen in a race with Hillary Clinton.
Right. And name recognition is huge. So just a consistent finding in polling world is that when somebody announces, they get a huge boost. It often is a bump and then it comes back down. But because when you poll people, especially far, far out like we are now, oftentimes they just name the person that comes to mind, like the most recent candidate they heard about this week. So if somebody announced a candidacy a few days ago, they're going to be like, oh,
so
yeah, I
then
heard about
I think it's
you know,
worth
whoever.
Thinking Cory about, you know, what are the issues that keep coming up and that have been rumbling, you know, at least, you know, since the 2006 campaign. And you do have these issues about health care. You have these issues about college. You have these issues about immigration, foreign policy. And when you start to look at the candidates, you know, I mean, I think you're absolutely right, Slade, that, you know, it's silly to try and figure out who is going to be the candidate for who knows, maybe even Trump won't even be the Republican candidate. But what are the issues that are going to be in play? And I think we have a pretty good set of what those are. And then you can start to extrapolate out to what kind of candidate gets in on that. And this is where somebody like Joe Biden, who, you know, has done this incredible kind of, you know, set of laps around America, where he was, you know, an up and comer when he came to this, you know, Congress and the Senate in the early 70s, became a joke in 1988 when it turned out that he had plagiarized his own like biographical speech that he would give, and then was a clown up through, you know, part of the Obama administration. And now he's the wise old man, and he can adapt into all of the policies that the Democrats want. And I think one of the things that we're not talking about, too, is that I think just as the Republicans, and I've talked to a lot of never Trump or kind of anti-Trump people who are like, I didn't vote for Trump. I don't like Trump. If you're a Republican, you're going to vote for Trump in 2020, pretty much. And I think one of the things that's different this time is that the Democrats are going to vote for the Democratic nominee, no matter who it is, because they understand that, yeah, Bernie Sanders got screwed by Hillary Clinton and the DNC, which was an arm of her campaign, but that they should have taken that bullet in the name of electing a Democrat rather than a Republican.
Well, Nick, there's one thing that you sort of overlooked there, I think, and that's the not overwhelming necessarily, but real desire on the part of the Democratic primary base to, I think, to move, first of all, to move away from the kind of old establishment that Joe Biden represents, but second of all, to not nominate a white guy. And a white and an old white guy who represents the old the old ways in the party establishment, who has sort of been with a leading figure in the Democratic Party as we know it, is, I think, someone who has a just a natural disadvantage, even
that's
if
a
Biden
point well taken
to adapt.
The identity politics, civil wars are going to be exquisite over the next 21 months.
I mean, this is a thing that Bernie Sanders has already dealt with. And there's, you know, in all of the write-ups of his announcement that, I read this morning, there is a mention of some of the concerns about the way his campaign treated women in 2016. And Bernie Sanders has, you know, taken note of that, asserted, has talked about, you know, more about criminal justice issues because of protesters at some of his campaigns. And but like this is a live issue. And I think that, you know, it's going to be part of the nominating process for Democrats.
I think
let's move from the role of the speculative to the role of the concrete here. And Nick, I'll go to you first so you can relieve your talking.
No, not at all.
Which is to say, last week, I believe it was on Friday, President Trump announced that he's signing a national emergency to help build some wall there. This is after the 35-day shutdown, the signing of $1.4 billion of money for 55 miles of border barriers and fences and sticks. And then he gave a press conference. I was indisposed during that press conference, but I came online just afterwards, and people were reacting to it with a sense of shell shock that I don't think I've seen since the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones. Nick, I think you...
But it's the same thing. We all knew it was coming, right? Like, I mean, it's,
no,
it's
we
been
knew
out
that
there
the declaration
for
was going to come,
right?
But I think it was the actual performance of the declaration, Nick.
It was.
I think I saw you having a mini stroke online. Can you talk us through that and then also your sense of the national emergency as the denouement of this tawdry episode?
So it's, I mean, one of the things is that that was a virtuoso performance by Trump. I mean, it was completely unhinged and bizarre and ranging all over the place, filled with braggadocio or braggadocio, whatever. A lot of bragging, a lot of self-bragging, even including up to saying that, like, I don't even need to do this because I've already built so much of the wall. But, you know, I want to do it now and get it, you know, do it quicker. It's he at one point he was like one sentence away from going into a full Charlie Chan voice when he was like recounting an conversation had with President Xi of China. And about, like, you know, why they don't have problems with drugs and illegal drugs in China. I mean, it was nuts. But it was also kind of great. Like, he manhandled and swiped people away. I think the way to look at the National Emergency Declaration, which, you know, a lot of legal scholars say, it is clearly a perversion of what the law was intended for, what the law allows, but that the courts will almost certainly not rule against it because technically it's within the parameters of that. I think it's worth looking at that as a being twinned with the discussions that have come out from Andrew McCabe talking about invoking the 25th Amendment, basically to say Trump is you know, not smart enough or he's demented and should be removed from office by a majority of cabinet members and the vice president, which is technically legal, but is clearly like we were we're in a place now where the laws and, you know, these things that were created to kind of hem people in and to kind of uphold norms are being tested and pushed aside. And this is something that Trump has done spectacularly. Like he does stuff and says stuff that people don't expect people to do. This was similar to Bill Clinton did a version of this by not stepping down and by, ignoring certain issues or like bombing countries whenever a domestic problem was getting too big for him. I think this goes to that sense of exhaustion that like the institutions and as importantly, the cultural norms and the political norms, behavioral norms that we expect from politicians have broken down in all sorts of ways. It's bizarre and it's strange and it leads to exactly what we're going through now, which is a diminution in the kind of the legitimacy of government. People don't have a lot of trust or faith or confidence in government because they know the people, you know, they know that it's kind of a house of straw.
I would add that the president on Friday or Saturday, I think it was Saturday morning, tweeted out something along the lines of, or it was Sunday morning, actually, because it was after Saturday Night Live, Saturday Night Live and networks like that should face retribution. This is president saying that a network should face retribution for mocking him in a way that he didn't find funny. And like no one talked about it. It's like, yeah. Oh,
whatever. He tweeted out like today or yesterday a video of a woman in like Africa or South America dribbling with a soccer ball like on her head and stuff like that. I mean, it's spectacular, but he's like, wow, you know, this is amazing. It's really, you know, it's just kind of amazing.
Slade, I got a weird question for you. So like one of the things that we've seen in the Trump era is that there's been, again, in polling, but there's been backlash on issues. Like Americans now are more against the wall than they've ever been. They're more pro-immigration than they've ever been. And so immigration or like the Trump's version of border security and the wall is like a minority issue, but super passionate among the 35% or so of people who are completely with him. And I'm making up that number, but for the sake of argument, are we headed towards a future where like you can like policy will be fought over what minorities believe in passionately and can try to like force over to the other side, thereby sparking a backlash? This may seem like a completely insane comparison, but it called to mind the kind of Terry Schiavo 2005, 2006 thing there, which passionately felt by a lot of people, a lot of conservatives, social conservatives in particular, that the government should intervene to help this woman live. And the rest of the country's like, what the hell are you doing with the federal government? Do you see this as kind of a future, given that we can't get to very many sort of 80% issues anymore?
Yeah, well, there are already other issues, mainstream issues, where this is the case. So, I mean, an example of this is abortion, which is an issue where the vast majority of Americans are in the middle, right? I mean, every poll finds that most people are somewhere between the two extremes. Even people who identify as strongly pro-life get uncomfortable when it comes to, you know, a baby that has certain prenatal diagnoses. Even people who are strongly pro-choice get very uncomfortable when we start talking third trimester. So most people are in the middle, but the conversation is dominated by the very small number of people who are on the two extremes, who also tend to be the people who go on TV and talk about it, who go march, and who they're the activists. The people who become activists are the ones who feel the most passionately, and who also are not necessarily representative of anything close to the median position. So it's not like this is totally unique to the wall. Actually,
yeah, I mean the thing that I was looking at the other day. How many members of the House of Representatives among Republicans are pro-choice? Anyone care to guess?
Among Republicans, pro-choice?
Republicans.
Zero.
Pro-choice Republicans in the House. It is zero.
Yeah.
That number is
none,
zero.
Yeah.
It didn't used to be zero.
It's been zero for like 15 or 20 years, though, hasn't it?
No. I think it's two or three years. I could be fact-checked on that, but from what I recall, there's two senators left there. But it's amazing the sort that has happened on these issues. Suderman, do you sense any useful Republican line in the sanding happening over Trump and the emergency declaration. I presume that Nancy Pelosi is going to call a vote on this at some point, from what I understand about parliamentary procedure, which is nothing, but I saw people tweeting about it with a sense of knowledge, she can insist that this gets voted on, a sense of the Senate, if nothing else, or a sense of Congress on this. Are there Republicans who are saying, I am going to vote against this thing because it's dumb?
Not really. So if you go back, Mitch McConnell during the shutdown warned President Trump this would be a bad idea. It could divide Republicans. But last week, when the deal to keep the government open and the emergency declaration were both announced basically at the same time, Mitch McConnell said, well, I'm going to support the president's declaration. He didn't have to do that. He could have said, well, you know what? We're not going to support the emergency declaration. We're going to put this bill to reopen the government, which is widely supported amongst Democrats and Republicans, or to keep the government open, I should say. We're going to put this on the president's desk. And if he doesn't like that I'm not supporting his emergency declaration, he can veto it. And you know what? We'll override the veto. And that is a thing that Mitch McConnell could have done. But Mitch McConnell is really setting the tone here in a lot of ways and kind of indicating where Republicans are with regards to the president, which is that they're going to perhaps privately gripe and warn him, you know, sort of preemptively, maybe that would be a bad idea, sir. And then they're going to support this stuff because that's where the Republican base is. And even though the majority of the public is just wildly against this, very strongly against both the border wall itself and even more strongly against the emergency declaration, the Republicans are by and large with the president in favor of the border wall, in favor of declaring an emergency to get around Congress. And I think it's worth also just sort of to go back to the legal question here, dwelling on this, it is possible that this will end up it's going to the courts. I believe 16 states are suing over Trump's emergency declaration. And we don't know how it's going to turn out. The actual sort of legal issues are complicated, but in many ways, I would say that there's a fairly straightforward kind of constitutional argument here, which is that the spending power is given only to Congress. And what Trump has done is unconstitutionally take the spending power from Congress, which looked at this and declined to give him the funds. This was not that they just were like, well, we don't have time, we're busy, or we're not taking this up at all. They declined to give him the funds after he repeatedly requested this. And so this is in no way a state of emergency in the way that it was meant to be used, which was basically allowing the president to act when Congress, for some reason, doesn't have time, has not yet. And it is a usurpation of congressional power.
I don't disagree
by the
with that, but it's also
clearly,
people like
that. I'm not saying that it will definitely be ruled illegal. What I'm saying is that just sort of from a constitutional design perspective, it's clearly wrong. It's clearly way beyond what the emergency power was meant to be used for. And it clearly does not respect the separation of powers that is built into the Constitution.
Nick, you
I was just going to say, I agree with that. But again, you know, people like Mike Lee, who is, the senator from Utah, who's a lawyer and is, you know, a strict constructionist, when it comes to constitutional powers, he's saying, like, I think this is a mistake. What Trump is doing, but I think it's technically legal. So,
Well, part of why it's a mistake is because of what's going to happen when the Democrats win the White House, which is going to happen eventually. It may not be next year, but it's going to happen sooner or later.
I mean, Nancy Pelosi all but said we are going to declare states of emergency on with regards to either guns or climate change.
But, you know, this is also, we're already living in that because of the way the filibuster rules were changed and Obama's use of executive orders and executive action in ways. So, again, to see this as a process. We're coming to the end of a process that has been going on pretty much for at least the 21st century, and the role or the what is under what the main effect is that it people are tired of, like, the status quo is not working. It's not restraining government in the right way. It's not forcing them to do the right things, like pass budgets or pay for, you know, what they're spending, et cetera. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are interested in kind of more extreme versions of what we've had traditionally, which is a more right-wing and a more left-wing populism.
But it's interesting that the system isn't keeping the two parties in check when it comes to exercise, when they're in power and it comes to exercising their worst impulses to change the rules to get what they want now. And, you know, whatever that means for the future, be damned. They're doing it and their supporters are basically with them. And I can remember, I'm sure we have all had this experience during the Obama years of talking to our Democratic friends who were defending whatever, pick a thing, whether it's getting rid of the, you know, overriding, getting rid of the filibuster for judicial nominees. Whether it was pushing Obamacare through, you know, with these procedural shenanigans, whatever it was. And we said, like, to our Democratic friends, like, don't do this. You're setting a bad precedent and you're going to give your opponents the same power when they come into office. And they just, like, waved it away and they weren't bothered. And the same thing is happening now on the other side. And it's you know, I think it gives us no pleasure to be right about to have been right about this. And when, you know, President Pelosi declares a state of emergency for climate change.
You mean President Ocasio-Cortez.
Right. You know, it's going to give us no pleasure to have been right then either. But I don't know what to do about it because the sort of the support for the wall being a fringe position, but, you know, being representative of the Republican base is the flip side or the mirror image of the Democratic field rushing out to the progressive fringe. They're going there for a reason because the incentives that, as you know, they survey the landscape and they think that the incentives are pushing them out to the far left, even though that's not where most of the country is. And so, I mean, this is not sort of the way in civics 101, the system is supposed to work, and yet it's what we're seeing.
I mean, to tie this back a little bit to the beginning of the conversation, you know, there's the Bernie Sanders made his impact, his mark on the Democratic Party as an independent. And so that is at least one model. But it's true that if you go back, the founders weren't super worried about parties. They sort of didn't envision parties being as strong as they are. Instead, they worried about Congress sort of grabbing up all the power or the executive trying to amass power. And so they built in checks between branches. But now what you see is that you have parties working across branches to keep power for themselves, and in particular to support executive power, and that is not something that the founders sort of worried about nearly as much, and so there are fewer protections.
Look,
built in.
We get the government we deserve, and kind of the government that we conjure up. And I think you know, Slade, to your question, like, what do you do about it? You know, partly all politics. You know, you can be kind of a realist and say all politics and you know, ideology follows local political battles and struggles for power, and you kind of cobble together an ideology after the fact to make sense of it, or ideology actually leads changes. And, you know, I think the truth is somewhere in between. In either case, this is where, for libertarians, I think we really do need to be articulating, and actually not just libertarians, but I think traditional liberals who believe in limited government, you know, not no government, but limited government, rule of law, this type of stuff. There is a new articulation of that, and it's in people like Tyler Cowen's book, Stubborn Attachments. I think Steven Pinker is working towards this position, even as he's often critical of libertarians. But, you know, there is a new discussion about those broad principles, that what you want is a government that is limited in power and scope and reach. And we talk about why that arose in the 19th century, in particular, flowered, and why it is a better system to deal with stuff. As well as looking at particular, you know, kind of local struggles and talking about the policies that actually are pragmatic. Because in the end, I think, again, we have fewer and fewer people who are identifying tightly with parties, and they're the most rabid. This, you know, makes total sense that the dead enders are always the ones who are willing to, you know, do the bayonet stand, at, you know, charge at the last stand and everything. We need to be appealing to people to show that there's an ideological reason as well as pragmatic reasons that a broadly libertarian view of the role of politics in everyday life and also in the economy is the better bet as more and more people are looking for an alternative.
We wanted to talk a little bit about the Amazon headquarters off-siting decision. So let's talk about it as a lightning round. I'm going to start with Nick. You think it's all good for Amazon to be exiting out of New York despite all the upsets and circular firing, squatting that's going on? Why say you this, Nick?
You know, basically because it was a bad deal. It was a crony capitalist deal where there were, you know, billions of dollars in tax benefits that were getting given to a particular company that are not available to everybody else. We should be against that. I think it also showcased, you know, that you want, you know, businesses don't want to move into a place where they know they're going to be bled every second for all sorts of stuff, even after a deal is kind of struck, et cetera. So it gives us a moment to have a conversation about what is the better atmosphere and climate for, you know, commerce and business in large cities. New York is going to be fine one way or the other. But I think, you know, and we also, it's time to start asking of, you know, of companies like Amazon or demanding of them in the same way that we would say with sports teams, like you don't get to, you know, you should be ashamed of yourself for bleeding localities. In states, et cetera, for unfair treatment. We understand why you do it. It doesn't make it right.
Slade, isn't Nick Gillespie naive in approaching particularly high tax, high regulation cities and states like New York? New York tends to be, don't those have to, if they're going to attract large people, have to create carve outs for big ticket items just because they have so many carve ins for everybody else?
Well, I mean, it's not like a universal and an eternal given that these states have to be high tax, high regulatory environments. Like, could reform in ways that would make them more, you know, more appealing for big companies to come to without then having to give $3 billion to AMP to Jeff Bezos, right? There's another way, a better way. That's the way that we are sort of been
and
advocating
actually,
all
Andrew
along.
Cuomo is dealing with that right now because the state is down over December and January in revenue, like about $2.8 billion from what they projected because of the limitations on state and local tax deductions, you know, under the Republican tax bill, which introduces tax competition that had gone missing because of the way the federal law was structured.
Now, I would maybe, I might disagree slightly with the idea that it's entirely a good thing for Amazon to be pulling out of New York. There were people who were going to be winners in that deal. There, you know, there were going to be jobs created. There were people who were going to, you know, there was going to be a sort of housing boom, you know, investment in new housing in Queens in theory. These are not bad things, and individual people's lives probably would have been made better off. And so I would hesitate to, I don't want to say something that sounds like it's feeding into the sort of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez narrative that the reason Amazon is bad is because it's big and has a lot of money and, you know, isn't particularly friendly to unions. No, I mean, the reason that Amazon was bad in this case is because it was essentially blackmailing cities into giving it lots and lots of taxpayer money. There's a different thing.
Suderman.
So I think it's worth just going back a little bit to look at the policy environment in Seattle, where Amazon has been headquartered, and in particular, the head tax that came up last year, which would have levied a $275 per employee tax on any Seattle business making more than $20 million a year. So that tax was put in place and then repealed about a month later. And that was pretty explicitly a tax targeted at Amazon. Basically, the city council decided, well, Amazon is rich. We need money. Amazon's got it. Here's a way to get money out of Amazon. And so my sense of a lot of the HQ2 search has been that it is designed to kind of spread Amazon out so that it is not under the kind of policy jurisdiction of any single local government that can just say, well, you're stuck here and we're going to take your money. And so the flip side of that, of course, is that they have been sort of saying, well, you have to give us money. You have to give us subsidies to go everywhere. And, you know, that's what we saw in New York. That's what we saw in Virginia, just over the water here in Washington, D.C. But in large part, I think the Seattle's move is about saying, well, being able to say to cities, look, we've got options. We've got another headquarters. We can always go somewhere else. You can't do this, you know, sort of giving them leverage against city governments that have become that are looking to organizations like Amazon basically to take money out of them. And you particularly see that, you know, sort of with Jeff Bezos' personal life. Disclosure, my wife works for The Washington Post. Jeff Bezos owns The Washington Post, though in his personal capacity, where, you know, we see now this argument that every billionaire is a policy failure and that sort of thing. And the idea that people simply should not be able to amass that much wealth. And so, you know, I do think there is something something to sort of creating a right of exit for companies, or the ability to say to city governments, look, we don't have to have our jobs here. The thing that I would say that I would also point out about this deal and or the end of the New York deal is what Amazon said was, well, fine, we're not going to do New York. Instead, we're going to continue along with our plans in the Washington, D.C. area and then in Nashville. And what does that do if they're moving a bunch of the jobs that probably would have gone to New York to the D.C. area? Is that that means that we are concentrating power further in Washington, D.C. Now, look, I live in Washington, as Matt likes to point out. In some ways, that is fine for me. The job market's great here. The economy, this was one of the best economies and housing markets in the country during the recession. But I'm not sure it's great for the country to sort of increasingly concentrate all of the power, both economic and political, in the capital
city. All right, let's go to our end of show. What are you consuming segments? I know that Slade has been frantically racking her brain for the last 50 minutes. Trying to come up with an answer here, so we'll let her go last. I'm going to start by saying that last night, for the first time in my life, I went to Carnegie Hall, which is a very, very nice venue, turns out. Very pretty, and had a great time. I was fortunate enough to watch my teenage niece, sing in a chorus, an angelic chorus of like 200 voices there. Incredible setting, wonderful. 10-year-old daughter lapped it up. But I've got bad news to tell people who are olds like me. The people in the audience, they clap between movements. They clap between movements, people. When did this happen?
There ought to be a law.
There shouldn't
you're
be a law.
Not really,
but there should be a
you're
lot
not really
of
upset about
side
this,
eyes. I'm absolutely 100% upset about this, Nick, because music in serious music, as we used to call it back in the days, is intended to be performed in a certain way and consumed in a certain way in a certain setting. And damn it, the rabble are out there disrupting both performance and the oral experience with an AU, and it makes me upset. Suderman, what have you been consuming?
I've been playing a couple of new video games. One, Anthem, which sort of got released this last weekend, and is a big sort of it's very much like Destiny, which is a big online game that I've written about a little bit here and there, which is sort of that it's a big persistent world that you play with a lot of other players, often in groups, in little kind of squads where you will attack a mission together, right? And so instead of kind of playing a game entirely on your own where all of the objectives are fulfilled entirely by you and there's no connection elsewhere, you've got two or three other players playing with you and you're all trying to accomplish the same objectives. Anthem is very much in that mode, although it also focuses much more on story. It's from the developer called BioWare, which is known for its very story-intensive role-playing games like Mass Effect. And then I also played just a little bit of a new game called Apex Legends, which is a free-to-play battle royale game. Somewhat like Fortnite, but with a couple of other kind of popular game type features in, sort of in that you have different character classes, somewhat like a game like Dota 2. The main thing that I would stress here, since I imagine that at least the three people who are on this podcast don't know what any of these things I'm talking about are or mean.
Accurate.
Is that all of these games, these are big, expensive to develop shooters. Apex Legends is actually free to play, so you can play all of the game without paying a dollar. But the main thing that I would stress about these games is that they are sort of interestingly designed primarily as social experiences, as ways to get people playing together. And We're seeing a lot more of that in the video game world, especially kind of post-Fortnite, which has now just become a revenue monster, expected to bring in several billion dollars over the course of this year. And Fortnite is free. You can play the whole game for free. You never have to spend a dollar. And in fact, the money comes primarily from people buying cosmetic upgrades that make their characters look different, but don't give them any more power. And so it's really a kind of interesting economic model, but it's also a sort of different way of thinking about video games that that is sort of obvious in some ways, in that video games have always been social experiences, you know, going back to the arcade days. But I think doesn't fit with the perceptions of games as being these kind of lonely, sort of intensely, you know, sort of personal and cut off pursuits.
There's no such thing as a free video game. Nick, what have you been consuming?
I have been recording a bunch of podcasts, and we have got two great ones coming up tomorrow and Friday. One is with Christina Hoff Summers and Deborah So, talking about gender differences and what are the limits of biology and culture and all of that. And then on Friday, I sat down and talked with Kurt Loder for an hour, talking about the Oscars and what movies he liked and didn't like from the past year, as well as talking about music and literature. He's a big reader as well. So I got those coming up. But I have been rereading, actually, Albert Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus. It seems like a good time to be thinking about existential angst and, you know, constantly repeating the same action, constantly hoping that, you know, in Sisyphus's case of moving a boulder up a hill, realizing that every morning you're going to start over in the same position, and exactly how do you deal with that? Because it seems a pretty good description of American politics and culture.
Speaking of being paralyzed by the blood of Christ, I just want to point out that The Cure...
Wow. Is that your transition to yep. Slade?
No, actually, it's my transition from Nick, because he's referencing Camus. Camus is the kind of existential reason for the band The Cure. And I just wanted to, is part of the reason why I married my wife, because she moved to Hungary because she was a part of a Cure worldwide pen pal club, and was good pals with a friend who lived in under communism in Hungary.
Matt, I think that was an entire Thomas Pynchon yep. novel in the space of about 250
words. And I'm wondering how she avoided the fate of Selena's number one fan club, Pen Pal.
This is a subject for a longer podcast. But The Cure is going to be inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And that that concert is nearby here in Barclays Center next month. And I'm very excited to try to mug somebody to steal their tickets. Slade? What have you been consuming?
I'm tempted to do a speaking of the blood yes. of Christ. I'm currently reading G.K. Chesterton's The Everlasting Man, which is the book that supposedly converted C.S. Lewis from being an atheist
wow.
to a Christian. But that's not very relevant to reason.
But
so
couldn't get
I'll
him
do
all
instead,
the way across the threshold into a Catholic Church. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. He only went to Anglicanism. but instead I'll do a speaking of the Oscars, since Nick mentioned talking to Kurt Loder about the Oscars. I went last week to see the movie Green Book, which is a Best Picture nominee. I was curious because I do, you know, I enjoyed the previous Best Picture nominee, Driving Miss Daisy. This is a very similar story. It's the basically Driving Miss Daisy with the races reversed, a white man driving a black man in the 60s, and the sort of relationship that forms between two people of different backgrounds. And it was very much like Miss Daisy, a feel-good, you know, racial reconciliation kind of film. But I was struck by how not right for the current moment it also felt. So this is not a moment, a political moment in America where people are feeling good about coming together and bridging previously, you know, gaping divides. Instead, it has sparked a controversy about whether it's okay to essentially make a movie that's called Green Book. So it's about this thing that is a huge part of African American history during the Jim Crow era. The fact that they had to you know, keep a record of which establishments would even allow them through the door and serve them or let them stay at the hotels or motels or whatever. And it's a movie that focuses actually on the driver, so the white character, and whether that's okay, and it's also based on a true story, whether it was really fair or, you know, portrayed the the black character fairly inaccurately. There's been some criticisms lodged by his surviving family members. So it's just an example of the, in the real world reaction to this movie that was supposed to be about feeling good and bridging divides and the ability, you know, the sort of wonderful ability of people to come together and be friends despite differences is, has shown itself to just, it's just really shone a light on.
I haven't seen it, Slade, but the primary criticism that I've read is that it's a white savior movie, ultimately. And is that the sense that you get, and that's the genre that's played out?
Because,
for instance, like Black Klansman, you know, another highly regarded movie of the year that's up for a bunch of Oscars, directed by Spike Lee, is, you know, didn't get that same critique.
Right. So in a way, in a very literal sense, this black concert pianist hires essentially a mob connected blue collar Italian guy to be his driver for this tour in the Deep South, basically to be the muscle. So he literally hires him to be the sort of to save him if he gets into any scrapes. So I can see where that critique is coming from. I don't know. I think the more interesting takeaway is about, or critique is actually about whether, whether it was accurate. You know, it's being held up as being based on a true story. It was, the screenplay was written by the son of the real life driver. And so whether it's okay to sort of use black history in this way. I don't necessarily have a strong opinion about whether it crossed a line or not, but I think it's very interesting that is what the conversation that has sparked, and not the one that, for example, came out of Driving Miss Daisy in 1989.
I think that part of it is that it reminds people of Driving Miss Daisy, which itself became kind of a symbol of that type of movie that people don't want to see made anymore.
Continue this of course the air is free, but I don't think that we didn't see that response to The Help, which is set in a similar time and is also treads kind of similar ground. Obviously there's differences. So, Slade, would you say, like, even in the time since The Help came out as a movie or was released as a novel to now, that there's been a significant change in people wanting to get along, or what are you sensing in the current moment?
Yeah, I think our politics have become more toxic, even in just the last 3-4 years. So that's definitely true. I actually haven't seen The Help, but I wonder, and can anybody confirm for me, is the story mostly about the African-American characters? Because that's part of the critique here, is that the central figure, the protagonist, is
it's
the white guy.
It's kind of mixed. Because there's Emma Stone's character is definitely, one of the protagonists, but there are at least two very strong and central, like forward African-American characters as well.
Well, I think that's all the awkward movie racial healing talk that we have time for here. Thank you for listening to the recent podcast. Go and subscribe to us. Thank you, Slade, for coming in and being irregular and shedding light that we wouldn't otherwise have on this podcast. And stay tuned for us next Monday instead of Tuesday, and for all the great stuff that Nick's got coming down the pike. Bye, everyone.